From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
The snail's pace of stem cell research. Hello again, I'm Orrin Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. When California voters approved $3 billion in bonds for stem cell research, they weren't told how long it might take to develop treatments for diseases that have no cures. That was in 2004, and the agency that was created is still trying to get research out of the lab and into the clinical phase. We'll hear what the latest $150 million in grants are for and what it's realistic to expect. Also tonight, Apple and Samsung, when two giants of high technology go to court, what does it mean for struggling startups? Later on, high-tech chemistry and the war on drugs. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Synthetic drugs with names like spice and bath salts are developing a fad all over the country. They mimic some illegal drugs, including meth, cocaine, and marijuana. But they are legally sold, often over the counter, and users pass drug tests. How dangerous are the unintended effects? Can law enforcement catch up with the chemistry? We'll have more on that later. First, this story. California's Institute for Regenerative Medicine is a unique state agency with guaranteed funding of $3 billion from bonds. It was created by voters in 2004 when the Bush administration opposed using embryonic stem cells for medical research. Here's a commercial from the campaign.
I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy in infancy.
He has to see a mirror image every day of his life of what he could be and what he should be as a twin.
Cerebral palsy has made my life very challenging.
Life is different with stem cells. It doesn't have to be that way.
I think stem cell research offers that potential to help not only me, but so many people who have debilitating and life-threatening conditions.
We don't know the whole promise of stem cells, but we're never going to know unless we do that research.
As you heard, we didn't know the whole promise, but the idea was to use embryonic stem cells to develop treatments for incurable diseases. Whatever the voters thought 8 years ago, that takes a long time. Last week, the Institute passed out its latest grants, $150 million, in hopes of moving from laboratories into clinical trials. Alan Trounson is president of the Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Good to have you on our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
Tell us what the latest grants are going for.
Well, I think there's seven projects that the board recommended, plus another five or six that were returned to the review committee to look at. But it goes from trying to set up a program to treat Huntington's disease, a very difficult neurodegenerative disease, which is an inherited condition, absolutely no treatment available, through to osteoporosis, loss of bone function, and inability to, you know, to be able to exercise without breaking bones, through to malignant melanomas, limb ischemia. This is problems with blood flow in your peripheral arms, legs, and so forth. That needs to be corrected, because that can lead to damaging conditions, spinal cord injury, and heart disease. So a big ramp of them. Additionally, I think I've just forgotten one. Oh, yes, ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. The board endorsed a way of moving towards seeing if we can help those patients.
How long do you think it will take to develop treatments for some of these conditions that you've listed?
I think, these projects are translational projects moving to the clinic. So they're moving from getting good candidates to doing those studies which show they're both safe and they're worth a treatment. That is, that they're actually result in a response in an animal model usually. And then they move into early clinical trials. They go through phase 1, 2, 3, and 4. In the early stages, it's really about safety, and then it moves to showing efficacy. So this all takes a long time. So we're talking about somewhere between 5 and 7 years before we get any of them into the marketplace where broadly the community can obtain them. I guess in the intervening period, if some patients are prepared to take the risks of entering into the clinical trials, and there's you know, you always have to do that because there's a certain risk associated with it not being effective when we move from animals to humans. But they could get early treatment in phase one, phase two, or even phase three clinical trials.
How long do you think it might be before that happens?
Well, that's happening now. So some of these projects are actually moving to the clinic. Some of them are 3 or 4 years off. So it depends on which projects we're talking about. Some of them are actually sort of now going into early clinical trials. So there's some work on the heart moving into early clinical trials. And so we're trying to find out where the cells are lodging and whether the cells are really safe for the patients. And are these really likely to have some impact in the longer term. So it depends what you're talking about. The neurodegenerative disorders tend to be a bit further away. I think they're sort of 2 to 4 years before they actually enter the clinic. Spinal injury has been in the clinic, but then there's a new program going to the clinic now. There's a new studies on cancers and melanomas. I think they'll move to the clinic in 2 or 3 years' time. So it depends on what condition we're talking about. But overall, in our portfolio, it includes studies that have already moved to the clinic and these new ones that are moving or about to move into the clinic.
Alan Transon, again, the president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. You mentioned malignant melanoma. I wanted to introduce Dr. Antoni Ribas at the Eli and Edith Broad Center for Stem Cell Research here at UCLA. Got $20 million from the Institute. Dr. Ribas, welcome to you.
Hello, Warren.
What can you tell us about the research that you're doing on malignant melanoma?
So I'm a medical oncologist, and I dedicate to this aggressive form of skin cancer that once it goes around the body, it gives metastases. Until recently, there were very few active therapies, but we're making a lot of progress in two fronts, in understanding what should we do to block the cancer from behaving like a cancer cell by giving targeted therapies, and what should we do to turn on the immune system to fight the tumor. And there's a lot of advances there, but what we're proposing to do in the grant that's been funded by CIRM is to make an army of immune system cells that attack the cancer by allowing them to regenerate in the body by gene modifying the stem cells that make the immune system.
How long will it take you, do you think, to get to the point of clinical trials?
Well, it has to be 2 years. That's what we proposed, and CIRM has strict timelines, so we have to meet them.
CIRM is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And then once you're in clinical trials, what happens after that? And I'm sure there's a great deal of uncertainty, but will people who have this condition now, do you think, be able to get treatment in time?
So obviously we'll start carefully and slowly and through a dose escalation. The first thing is safety. We'll obviously be interested in understanding, are we achieving the goals that we want to achieve to regenerate this cancer-fighting immune system to fight melanoma? But we could also do other cancers with just little changes of the targeting motifs that we're using.
Dr. Antoni Ribas again at the Broad Center at UCLA. Back to Alan Transon, the president of CIRM, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. $3 billion from the voters in 2004. That's $6 billion altogether once you include interest. At what point are you going to get to the point where you run out of that money and are going to have to seek other kinds of funding?
Well, we began the grants late in 2006 because you have to remember there was 2 years spent in court actions defending the establishment of CIRM, Proposition 71. So we think that we'll be making new grants up to 2017, perhaps a little longer, but not much longer than that. And thereafter, there would be a four-year time frame for the rundown of funds that were allocated in 2017. So we're talking about 2021, 22. So that's the extent of it at the moment. And unless we got refunded, that's what we're currently looking at.
Are you looking at alternatives to public funding?
We are looking at lots of different alternatives. We're including partnerships with the pharmaceutical industry and big bio. We're looking at other ways of raising money through foundations and so on. But I think in the end, the most likely way of getting that kind of quantum of funding that we've got at the moment is through public funding. But at this stage, we're not concentrated on that particular issue at the moment. But as you said, we are aware that there is a sum down on the funds at some point in time.
And it appears that there's less and less enthusiasm for government funding on the part of voters. Do you feel that you have pressure to develop therapies, to come up with concrete results, to be able to show that you've been able to cure diseases in order to get to continued public support?
Well, I think everybody who has a condition or has someone in the family or friends who've got these serious conditions where there really is really good treatment or very, very little treatment available to them wants this to happen as soon as possible. But we've got to get research like Tony Rebus has just described to you going in the first place. We needed to support that. We needed to convert it to a translation stage and then get it onto the clinic. So this really does take time, and that part of it, people will need to recognise, because the regulatory agencies, the FDA, require us to go through these processes, and quite rightly so. So is there pressure on us? I mean, I think the pressure of actually demonstrating some of these discoveries, moving to the clinic, is on us, but we can only do that at the proper rate, and we can't be hurried because the process is very well defined. The scientists have worked through some fantastic discoveries, and we've got a big pipeline of opportunities coming. And I hope really by 2014, 15, 16, we'll be able to show some what we call proof of concept in the clinic, that we're not only that the treatments are safe, that Tony is able to show his treatment is safe, but it's also effective in actually removing those cancer cells. And in the other projects, of course, we want that to be happening as well. So, yes, some pressure, but it really wouldn't make a difference to the speed that we move, because it's really governed basically by the research groups and the regulatory agencies.
Dr. Rebus, we have very little time left, but is there still objection to the use of stem cells by various people? Do you have difficulty getting a hold of them, or because of what was passed by voters in California, are you no longer restricted in any way?
The kind of stem cells that we use don't come from an embryo, so there's a lot less controversial, and I would, from my interactions with patients and advocacy groups, there's a lot of positive feedback on the concept of regenerating tissues and fighting disease by doing that.
So are you optimistic that you'll be able to meet the kind of deadline that Alan Townsend is talking about?
We have to. So we'll stick to it. We'll work hard, and we'll try to get something back in return of this funding.
All right. Well, I hope both of you will come and give us progress reports from time to time. And, of course, more grants will be given out as time goes on as well. Very quickly, Alan Townsend, of the $3 billion, how much is left?
Well, we've allocated around $1.6, $1.7 billion of it. So there's a little over $1 billion left to be allocated. So we're in the crucial allocating phase, if you like, for making the best use of all of our funds. We've initiated the projects. We've got the basic work going. We've engaged now in translation. We're moving it towards the clinic. So we've got a little bit of finance left. A bit over $1 billion is more than a little bit, really. And so I think there's great opportunity for us to show the community that this has been a great experiment, and that's what we hope will be demonstrated within a few years.
Well, thank you both. Alan Townsend, president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, Dr. Anthony Rebus at the Broad Center at UCLA. Good to have you both on our program, and thanks so much.
Thanks, Warren. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter @WWLA.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. In a San Jose federal court today, an attorney for Apple told jurors that internal documents will show that Samsung made a specific decision to copy the iPhone because it could not compete on its own. It's the start of a patent infringement case that could take a month to try. Marissa Gluck is co-principal of Radar Research. That's a consultancy that advises new media, entertainment, and design companies on digital strategy. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thank you, Warren.
Tell us a bit more about this suit, which I gather represents a whole series of similar kinds of suits that are going on now.
Yes. Apple has been engaged in a lot of litigation against Samsung over the last year or so in across, I think, 10 countries at this point. And there's something like 50 lawsuits that range in terms of patent infringement. So this is just one more salvo in the war between Apple and Samsung over the design of their iPhones and iPads, their tablets.
As our listeners look at their iPhones and iPads or tablets, can they see anything that is being argued about, or are the issues all deep in the machinery?
It ranges. Some of it is about the design, the look and feel, and in some cases Samsung has made concessions in terms of changing the design of their tablets to appease some of the lawsuits. In other cases, it's about the functionality of the phone itself. So there's a lawsuit over unified search, so whether or not it's an infringement to have a search function on the phone that looks at both the Internet and the phone at the same time.
What sort of changes has Samsung made to adjust to Apple's concerns about the look and feel?
I believe it was in Europe. They added a thin bar to the top of the tablet so that it wasn't a full glass window, which Apple claimed was a design infringement.
So I would think it would be hard to patent something like the size of the window.
Yeah, you would think so. Apple has, quite a number of patents, as does Google, and Google's acquisition of Motorola Mobility, or their attempt to last year, was simply to acquire 17,000 patents from Motorola. So all of the smartphone manufacturers and the OS developers are engaged in this war with each other over intellectual property.
So I take it then that when you develop something, you get as many patents as you possibly can.
You try to, and very often the patent office does approve them, which is why Samsung is now claiming that the patents are too broad.
Too broad, and what would that mean, generally speaking, to a lay audience?
Basically saying that Apple is claiming that if you have a tablet where things like the multi-touch function or being able to swipe things across is only owned by Apple, other manufacturers are claiming that that shouldn't be something that just Apple owns the rights to.
Marissa Gluck at Radar Research. Patrick Houston has written that even though the battle, this particular battle at least, has just begun, it already has a loser. He is a former editor-in-chief at CNET.com. He's co-founder of Media Architects, a consulting firm, as well. Good to have you on our show.
Good to be here.
Who's the loser?
We are. You, me, consumers, small companies, innovation, and as a result, the economy at large.
Let's talk about small companies and innovators. How are they losers when Apple and Samsung get into this kind of battle?
Well, Apple and Samsung are actually capitalizing on the same weaknesses in the patent law that a number of patent trolls are, too. Patent trolls have cost companies upwards of $29 billion in direct costs alone in 2009. That doesn't count the time that those companies had to spend in court or for settlements, or the delays that they had to swallow for their products. So the trolls will claim that they're defending other small innovators and inventors, but they're not. Researchers that I cite in the column that I just wrote actually found out that it's a net loss to innovators. They're paying more than they get from these patent infringement cases.
Tell us more about who is a patent troll.
Patent troll are companies that are called non-producing entities. They're actually companies that buy up patents for the sake of asserting claims and then making money on those claims through either court damages or settlements.
And so companies that don't think it's worth it to do that are willing then to sell them the patents?
Yeah, it's a pretty sad situation. You know, a small company will say it'll cost us more to fight it than it will just relent. There are small companies that are being put out of business.
Because they have to go into court and acquire all of the costs that you mentioned?
It's having a chilling effect, yes.
Let me go back to Melissa Gluck. What efforts are you aware of, if any, to change the situation and try to reform the patent system, which Patrick Houston says needs to be done?
I'm not sure if there's any real concerted effort right now to change the patent system. There are a lot of entrenched forces that like it the way it is and that would, if they had their druthers, actually increase the length of patent law. So there isn't really, other than, I guess, organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Creative Commons, which are more focused on copyright than they are on patent law, there's not really much being done right now.
So this is going on Apple's part in 10 countries. They've got 50 lawsuits going?
Between the two companies, there are about 50 lawsuits.
Between the two companies,
mm-hmm.
I see. So
these are multinational lawsuits.
So Apple is suing Samsung. Samsung is suing Apple and other companies as well?
Yes.
So it's not just then the patent trolls. It's some of the major industries in the high-tech area.
Yes, and the dispute between Apple and Samsung is also really about the dispute between Apple and Google, because Google provides Android, the operating system for Samsung phones. So a lot of this is Apple's way of going after Google somewhat indirectly.
So Patrick Houston, back to you then. It's not just about squeezing the little guy out. It's also about competing with your equals.
It sure is. And there's another specter here. And what you see happening is that Apple, Google in particular, are beginning to assert dominance in mobile. And I think that's a real danger here. There are 150 now packages of patents out in the marketplace. Those patents will bring a pretty penny. The only companies that can afford those patents are big ones, like Microsoft, like Amazon, like Google, and like Apple. So we are getting to a point, I fear, where those companies are beginning to assert an undue amount of dominance in a market, mobile, in which we all have a huge stake.
Patrick Houston, be a little more specific, if you will, about what it means for a few companies to have dominance in an industry like mobile. To what extent will that slow things down?
Sure. You recall what happened with Microsoft and its dominance in the operating system market back in the 1990s, when there was a huge antitrust case brought against it. What's going on now is that companies like Apple and Google are also propagating what we might think of as closed systems. Apple keeps you in a closed system by virtue of having control over the hardware, the software, and increasingly the content. This is the same for Google and actually the same for Microsoft and Amazon, but to a lesser extent. So that is, in addition to the patent wars in which they're participating in, we also have this other dynamic in which they are beginning through the patent wars to consolidate their already emerging and dominant positions in mobile.
Melissa Gluck, what about the argument that the reason we have patents is to protect money that will be spent on research and development, and that governments are in charge, partly at least, of helping companies do that? Does that generate any sympathy for these big companies we're talking about on your part?
I think that there's a fine line that is being crossed. I think that the origins of intellectual property law was to encourage innovation. It was the idea that if a person could own their invention for a certain number of time, they'd be more incentivized to create new inventions or innovations in the marketplace. That goes back essentially to the founding of this country. It's much harder to have sympathy. The intention there was for the small inventor. the small innovator. It's much harder to have sympathy for multi-billion-dollar multinational corporations like Apple and Google and Samsung when they're trying to protect their intellectual property at the expense of consumers.
Using the patent law for exactly the opposite reason from the one that led to it
exactly.
In the first place. Patrick Houston, what did it take to deal with that Microsoft issue, which was so such a big one, so expensive for so many people? And will it be needed again with regard to Apple or one of these other companies?
It's not so clear-cut in this case quite yet. In the Microsoft case, Microsoft was touting a market share of upwards of 90%. That made it pretty clear that they had reached market dominance and they'd done it through asserting anti-competitive practices. Now, that remains to be seen here. And I think what I'm doing, among others, is beginning to raise a yellow flag to the consequences of closed systems and the patent wars, the IP wars, here in a market that's really, really essential to everything that we do.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about it, and thank you both for being on our program. Patrick Houston, co-founder of Media Architects, Marissa Gluck with Radar Research. Good to have you both.
Thank you so much,
Warren. Thank you. Good to be here.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page, and in a moment, high-tech chemistry and the war on drugs on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Last week, the Drug Enforcement Agency arrested 90 people in 31 states and seized millions of packets of powder with names like Spice and Ivory Wave. Some even had labels reading unfit for human consumption. What were they? Synthetic chemicals that mimic marijuana, cocaine, and methamphetamine. But that's not all they do. Poison centers around the country report violent reactions that last for weeks from drugs that have never been medically tested. Picked up along with the synthetic chemicals was $36 million in cash. Jeffrey Scott is spokesman for the DEA. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
What's going on here? How big an issue is this?
Well, I think it's an emerging problem. It's something that we've had our eye on for a couple of years, but it's a significant problem, from an investigative standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, and from a forensic standpoint. You know, these class of compounds, these synthetics, represent some challenges.
Why is it so difficult to get a handle on this? It's my understanding that people are buying them in part because they think they're legal.
Well, I mean, there is that aspect of it. The kind of idea of legitimacy of these products, has spread the prevalence of them, and I think the openness of their original sales. But, the chemistry presents some problems. They can be, modified and changed somewhat quickly. And I think it's important to understand that from a regulatory standpoint, we don't necessarily ban, the cartoon names of these things, Blue Wave or Blue Dolphin or Ivory Wave. What we ban or control or regulate are the actual chemical compounds within them. So products show up on store shelves. And really, it's irrelevant what the outside packaging says. It's really irrelevant, what warnings may be on the packages. What is of concern is actually what's in these packages, and determining that can be a little difficult.
Describe how the chemicals get changed. Once one is made illegal, a new one comes along.
Well, I mean, the chemistry is beyond me, but it's not beyond, individuals who've spent some time working at this. And, we last year initially banned or temporarily scheduled, emergency scheduled, actually is what we did, a certain number of these chemical compounds that our forensic chemists had identified were showing up again and again in some of these products that people were taking and, showing up at poison control centers. However, that was just a small subset of them. Over time, with some effort and initiative, chemists can change a molecule there or tweak a formulation here, and come up with something that is close to what we ban, but not exactly. Then that, from a regulatory standpoint, requires kind of another round to go back at it. We have our Analog Act through the Controlled Substances Act, which allows us to kind of tackle these close but not same chemicals. But what we're trying to do is draw a box around these compounds and as big a box as possible, so that we can deal with some, you know, with the tools that I have investigatively, and then, you know, create prosecutable cases.
You say they appear on the shelves of stores. What kind of stores?
Well, I mean, we have seen them, you know, in convenience stores, supermarkets, head shops, places like that. You know, I think one of the things that our initial, you know, emergency scheduling and now the more recent addition of some 26 of these synthetic drugs to the CSA has done has moved them off of some of the more prominent sight lines in some of these stores. I'm not suggesting you can't find these things if you know what to look for and what to ask for. But, you know, the kind of openness that we saw, you know, maybe even 6 months ago, I think some of that has been diminished.
What about the Internet?
Well, the Internet presents a problem for all sorts of substances, not just the ones that I have to deal with. You know, the Internet is an open marketplace. It resists a certain amount of regulation. And, you know, the Internet has allowed kind of the proliferation of not only the sales of these sorts of products, but also simply the knowledge that they're out there and that they can be taken and that they can be used for, you know, a high.
Who are the principal users?
Well, I think that, you know, there might be some other people on your show who can talk about that as equally well as I can. But, you know, unfortunately, what we have seen is that a lot of these products tend to be targeted at, you know, young adults and teens. That's not all that we've seen, but, you know, I think the information about them has passed through, you know, our young adults.
Jeffrey Scott, once again, spokesperson for the DEA. Natasha Vargas Cooper is a freelance reporter, wrote an extensive piece called Bath Salts, Deep in the Heart of America's New Drug Nightmare. That was for Spin magazine. Natasha Vargas Cooper, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
I understand you were trying to market this story for a couple of years before you finally were able to get it published.
Yeah, I had heard just through, you know, some other people who work in the beat of drugs and recovery and addiction that there was this new thing called bath salts and spice looming around. And all I did was set up a Google alert for it, and over a year, it was, you know, report after report of a pretty, like, of pretty horrific, violent outbursts of small rural communities being devastated by it, because all it would take is kind of one local head shop to have it on their shelves. And I thought it was a fascinating story, as Jeff said, from the regulatory standpoint, from the investigatory standpoint, proposes a real challenge. So I had this story for about 2 years in my back pocket and went from magazine to magazine saying, I think this is going to be a big issue. I think this is a big deal. And it's complicated, and it's not as straightforward as crack, and it's not as maybe sexy as some of the other drugs. So I kept getting turned down. And then finally, Spin Magazine decided to take a chance, and we were able to get the story out there. It also helped, I think, raise people's consciousness. It just happened coincidentally was the Miami cannibal attack, or the, you know, clearly a man who had a psychotic break attacked another man and attacked him by chewing his face. And the police speculation at the time, the first thing the police said were, oh, this looks like a result of bath salts. Now, it was proven that it wasn't bath salts, but it was because this has become such an issue within law enforcement that that was the first thing that people thought about, and then it really raised, you know, public consciousness about it. But yeah, for a while, it's been under the radar in a lot of ways outside of, you know, what folks like Jeff and I think maybe on the healthcare side have been dealing with.
You talked to people and went with people who were using these drugs, various ones. How would you describe the effects that you saw, and how easy was it for the people to get the drugs in the first place?
Well, I'll start with your second question, which is it was actually easier than I understood it to be. For one, I'll give you two quick examples. We were in Nevada and in Las Vegas, where there was a big concentration of head shops, and we would walk into the head shops and ask around, and it was very clear that they knew exactly what we were talking about, that they said that they had carried it before, but they don't carry it now because it's been scheduled and it's a felony to carry it. And so
they didn't want any part of it. We got hooked up with some street kids, and we asked them, you know, do you guys know about it? Do you guys, could you guys get access to bath salts? And they got it within 5 minutes, and it was from their dealer, who explained that when bath salts were being sold in head shops legally, that he just bought them in bulk. And so because a lot of states and counties don't drug test for the chemicals found in bath salts, whenever one of his users, the drug dealer's users, needed to come up clean on a urine or blood test, he had this alternative. So it's right there on the street level. And then in Ohio, I was there with the drug task enforcement, the local police, and I had been into the head shop before, and I was looking, I didn't see it. They had a sign that said, no bath salts, don't ask for them, we'll kick you out. And, you know, the raid started. I was like, I wonder what they're going to get. And they came out with over 250 packets of this synthetic, of this drug that mimics, you know, being on meth and cocaine, and it was under the name Hookah Cleaner. When I was with the people who did bath salts, there wasn't any violent or extreme reaction because they fortunately didn't have a psychotic break, which is what these drugs can trigger. But it was, you know, what you would imagine if you've ever spent an hour in a hotel room with a meth addict to be. They are erratic. They don't have quite a clear sense of what's going on. They're hyperactive, hyper-aware. Fortunately, I knew these people to be docile and friendly, and primarily heroin users. So this wasn't their drug of choice. I could only imagine what it would be like if you were taking these drugs weekly. I don't think it would end in a very good result.
Did they have any really good idea of what they were taking?
No, none whatsoever, especially because of the packet. Like Jeff had said, the packaging doesn't mean anything. It just, it could be practically anything. There could be a tremendous amount of one chemical and hardly any of the other, two huge doses of the other. They even said at one point they, you know, sprinkled it in water so they could shoot it, and you could see the what was actual drugs versus what was basically what you'd call packaging, that a lot of it floated to the bottom, and that, no, you have no sense of, you know, from a drug user standpoint, from a consumption standpoint, the purity of what you're taking. So it's really, it's a blind bet. So the advantage of it is that it's easy to get, and you can somewhat get it in a non-criminal exchange. So that's the big advantage. The advantage is not necessarily the high it gives you, because sometimes you may not get any high because it's just bunk, or sometimes you can get way more than you bargained for.
Natasha Vargas Cooper, again, freelance reporter, wrote to Bath Salts, Deep in the Heart of America's New Drug Nightmare, for Spin magazine. Jeffrey Scott, back to you with the DEA. What are we talking about here? As I understand, spice, which is supposed to be synthetic marijuana, is in fact just leaves of one kind or another sprayed with chemicals. Is that right?
Yeah, K2 and spice are kind of generic terms for, you know, kind of a green leafy material, plant material that has been sprayed or impregnated, I think is the word that chemists often use, with, you know, some of these synthetic compounds. That's what you're dealing with you know, the synthetic marijuana, the K2 and spice, in terms of the synthetic stimulus.
So it's really not marijuana at all. It has nothing to do with it.
No, it's not even close. In terms of the bath salts, or glass cleaner, you know, those products, you're talking about pretty much a straight chemical compound that might be diluted or adulterated with some other powder, but it's not put on the, you know, green leafy or, you know, herbal type substance the way the synthetic marijuana is.
Cindy Schrader is executive director of the Casa Grande Alliance. They're working to address substance abuse issues in Pinal County, Arizona. That's between Phoenix and Tucson. Ms. Schrader, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what you're doing at a local level to try to cope with this.
Warren, we're doing everything we can to get the word out about these drugs. We're especially concerned about spice in our area. We're seeing that more than we are seeing the bath salts. I have spoken with about 50 parents just in the last 2 days. We're working with our middle schools trying to get the word out because parents do not know about this drug, and the children do. The ones who do know about it believe that it is not really a drug. They think that spice is safe because it is legal. And so we're trying to educate parents in the first place, and then also other adults. we also are trying to work with our prosecutor and see if we can get some good prosecutions on this. That seems to be a bit of a challenge. I am excited to know that there are other places across the country that are arresting people for spice. I spoke with one of our drug recognition experts yesterday from our local police department who said that he's stopping people kind of right and left that are high on spice, and we're not quite sure how to prosecute them because when you drug test them, unless you specifically test for those chemicals, for those analogs, then we can't show that they were intoxicated on something in specific.
How do they know then that they were high on spice?
Well, to tell you the truth, when they stop them for erratic driving, they admit it. Because this is a legal drug, they'll say, boy, you look really high. What are you high on? They say, oh, I'm high on spice. And on a scale of 1 to 10, these drivers are admitting being at a 7 or an 8 on the how high are you scale. They're significantly impaired. And so they can, of course, be cited for being impaired, but it's difficult to cite them for a chemical that you can't necessarily identify in the blood.
You say this is legal. It's not legal. We just heard under federal law, at least some chemicals aren't legal. What about the analog drug, or does Arizona simply not have any laws at all in this area?
We certainly do. We have a state law that does, as Jeff explained, there is a list of the drugs that are not allowed to be in your possession or be on these drugs. But the makers just simply pull out another list of drugs and start spraying that on the leaf litter instead of what they were using in the first place. So you have Spice and Spice 2, the second generation. So it really is, as I think Jeff said once before, kind of like whack-a-mole. Trying to keep track of all of this is quite difficult. And we're very thankful that President Obama supported the recent federal legislation. Now we need to kind of clear up confusion at the local level and get local legislation from each state that mirrors that. And short of that, maybe even local ordinances. So Okay. That's what we're going to be looking at.
Once again, Cindy Shader is executive director of the Casa Grande Alliance in Pinal County, Arizona. Maya Solovitz is health writer for Time magazine, wrote a recent piece called Should the FDA Regulate Recreational Drugs? Welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Answer the question. Should the FDA regulate recreational drugs? Should they be essentially legalized, you're suggesting, or that question is suggesting, and subject to regulation?
I think we need to consider very seriously the approach we are taking to drug misuse. People were talking earlier about whack-a-mole. With the technology that we have today, this is going to be an increasing problem because the technology for making new chemicals and for just getting them out there, getting them to people, getting the information to people is only going to get better. And the demand for drugs is always going to exist. It existed before we evolved into humans. We have catnip for a reason. And so it's a very, very complicated issue. What I was trying to raise in the piece was to say, wait a minute, we have an agency that is here to regulate drugs. We have a problem of people marketing completely new substances that have never been tested, sometimes never in animals. They've never been tested in humans. We have no idea what they will do. We have an entire history before the FDA of people dying in large numbers from poison drugs and from drugs that just turned out to cause horrible things like thalidomide damaging babies. So I wanted to raise the question of, you know, people are using these things. People have always taken drugs. What can we do to reduce the harm? Is regulation of something an idea that we need to consider? And I really do think it is, and I think that the drug we need to start with is marijuana because there's thousands and thousands of years of history of this drug being used, and it is demonstrably less harmful than alcohol and tobacco.
Okay, but what about these drugs we're talking about now and the fact that nobody really knows what they are? How can you regulate something if you're not certain what its constituencies might be?
Well, I think you really need to ban this. This is where it gets complicated and difficult. I think that we need to figure out a way to have people meet the need they have for escape in the least harmful possible way. I think a lot of people who are using these drugs would prefer to use marijuana. And I think that if you want to reduce the demand for these drugs, that's one way to go. I think, you know, people think, as you say, a lot of people are going to these things because they think it's legal and safe, and it's not. We are going to have this continual problem of you can't actually ban something just because it gets you high. That's not a good definition. It's going to mess with the pharmaceutical industry because let's say we ban everything that acts like an amphetamine. Well, suddenly the person who's trying to create the new Ritalin can't do that. It is an enormously complex intellectual property and all kinds of other, you know, I mean, one of the interesting things I think is that some of these cannabinoid compounds that were banned may actually act against Alzheimer's. Do we want to accidentally ban something that might be the treatment for Alzheimer's? It is an enormously complicated problem. And what I wanted to say is, you know, why don't we offer a pathway towards legitimate regulation?
Let me go back to Cindy Shetter with the Casa Grande Alliance in Pinal County, Arizona. What do you think of that?
I think it is a complex problem, and I don't think that marijuana is as safe as we want to believe that it is. Marijuana is very addictive. There are people that can't hold down a job because they'd rather get high. So thinking of marijuana as a legitimate choice, I think is dangerous ground.
What about, though, the mysteries that lie behind all of these other drugs, which can be changed so rapidly and so on, and what about the possibility of accidentally banning something that might be beneficial?
I don't think that's going to happen because there is a lot of research being done on, I'll certainly use marijuana as an example, and there are chemicals within it that have been used and identified for medical use. So I think that as long as the research keeps going on, there is a possibility we could find, if we find a chemical that does help Alzheimer's, my preference would be, I actually have a parent that just died that had Alzheimer's disease, and if there was a chemical that was within marijuana that could have helped her, I would have liked to have seen that created in a lab so I could be guaranteed what dose she would be getting, as opposed to using a natural product that I have no promise of what the dosage would be. So I, in answer to your question, I believe that there is a lot of research going on that if there's helpful things within these illegal chemicals, they'll be found.
Natasha Vargas Cooper, back to you. Once again, our freelance reporter for Spin Magazine wrote the article, Bath Salts Deep in the Heart of America's New Drug Nightmare. Do you think regulation would have an impact on use? And if so, what would it be? Would people be able to go and look at a list of ingredients or something of that kind? And would that be a better way to cope with this than simply banning things outright?
Well, one of the issues here is that I don't think that all drugs are made equal and not all effects of the drugs are made equal. So what you're talking about here is if we're talking about synthetic drugs, we're talking about spice and we're talking about bath salts. And with spice, it's a different issue because it mimics cannabis. With bath salts and the like, it's mimicking cathinones. And cathinones are methamphetamine, cocaine, and then also with bath salts are hallucinogens. So let me just separate cannabis out from that. With the cathinones, I don't see a particularly compelling reason to have those legal or regulated in the community based on the effect that they have on the body, which is largely in bad cases and in many cases is to have it can induce a psychotic break with reality, accelerated heart rate, and it's not one of these drugs that cathinones aren't something that really kind of work in moderation. And so for me, I don't, and based on what I saw and just being in and around the addiction and recovery community, is that I don't see a particularly justifiable reason besides, you know, that, well, these other things are legal, why can't this be legal, to have that be made, to have things like cathinones be readily accessible and have the criminality taken out of it. I know that one of the things that I found the most disturbing about bath salts and what I reported on was a family whose son had gone to the local head shop. We saw it from his bank statements almost daily, sometimes weekly, to buy spice and to buy bath salts. In rehab, he wrote letters about his struggles with it. He ended up having a psychotic break, essentially, and hanging himself in his family's garage. And his parents absolutely believe that bath salts led to his downfall. Part of the reason why they were so accessible is because, and part of the reason why he did it with such willingness is because he didn't have to get any of these drugs from a dealer. He didn't have to engage in any criminal activity. All the criminality was taken out of it. He could just walk into a drugstore and buy these products. And I have to believe that this drug appeals to people who don't want to engage in some, who would maybe be deterred by engaging in a criminal activity. So to me, you know, ready, easy, decriminalized access to cathinones is not something I would like just as a community member. I don't see a real reason for that.
Okay. All right. That's all the time we have. Thank you all very much for being with us. Maya Sanlovich with Time, Natasha Vargas Cooper, freelancer, having written recently for Spin Magazine about this issue, Cindy Shader with the Casa Grande Alliance in Pinal County, Arizona, and Jeffrey Scott with the DEA. Good to have all of you on our program, and thanks very much for being with us. We'll try to keep up with the effort to get a handle on this issue. That's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl, Caitlin Schamberg, and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Visit the Which Way LA blog for more stories about Southern California at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.